Lecture 26, Lyrical Ballads, Collaborative Creation.
In our chronicle of English literature, we're now at the turnover between the 18th and the 19th centuries. Something very interesting, very important happened at this period. It's conventionally called the Romantic Revival. Now, the term revival actually sounds gently to the ear. It's the kind of thing one can imagine dusty scholars doing, digging in archives, reviving things, bringing them back to life, revisiting forgotten styles and subject matters in a spirit not of fury but of nostalgia. How charming those old romances by, what was his name again? By Malory. How charming they are. We can imagine a revivalist saying. But what we actually see happening in literature of this period could, I think, much more accurately be called the Romantic Revolution. And the word revolution carries with it all the ferocity and danger that we associate, say, with Robespierre. Old orders are falling, and with it, new orders emerging, but with a certain kind of violence. Now, historically, in the real world, not literature, the period from 1796 to 1798 is an age of revolution. That's what the historians call it. We can go back further to the American Revolution, 1776. Europe, in these turbulent decades, seethes with upheaval. At the time, for people living through these events, it must have seemed like chaos. Come again. Now, we, with the advantage of historical hindsight, see it as the emergence of irresistibly reshaping energies of reform and renewal. We can see the architecture. They couldn't. Now, the most famous historical revolutions are, of course, those in North America and in France. And the reverberations from those cataclysms, 1776, 1789, would shake the whole globe for half a century. And their effects are still major features on our world geopolitical landscape. And, as we'll see, English literature too partook in the upheaval and was reshaped by it. Now, the literary timeline we're looking at in these lectures was materially bent and redirected by what happened in the years 1770 to 1830. As a general observation, revolutions presume certain conditions and share certain general features. These may be listed as intolerable oppression, which is finally and often violently resisted. Revolutions are not polite events. Secondly, revolutions are typically a movement of the people. They are populist in essence. They come from below, not on high. Thirdly, revolutions have a program, a vision, typically utopian, relating to some idealized, future, perfect state of social existence. Revolutions are, in essence, prophetic and millenarian. Often they're secular in motivation. They offer a paradisal vision of the future, which is not Orthodox Christian or Orthodox religious. Now, bear those three elements in mind. As we shall see, they help understand what happened to English literature with explosive effect around 1800. And all these three conditions that I've talked about are relevant. But first, something about the revolutionaries we'll be looking at themselves. In this case, William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Now, it's significant that what these two writers achieved with their most incendiary and effective volume, Lyrical Ballads, is that rarest of things in English literature, a team effort, a collaborative work of creation. Now, literature of the modern period from Chaucer forward, in our terms, is normally invariably rooted in individual sensibility. The author is a single entity, a single voice, creating highly individual literary artifacts. Literature expresses at its highest level of articulation the self, not the collectivity. And if one takes the longest of views, single authors have not always existed, of course. So it's doubtful that Beowulf was so composed. We talk of the Beowulf poet, but he was probably a they. Nor, as one looks far into the future, may single authorship be a permanent fact of our culture in time to come. But from our point of view, and our millennium and a half of English literature, single individual authorship is the rule. The writer writes, as we all dream, alone. And as we all read, of course, usually, alone. Nonetheless, in the breakthrough romantic text that we're looking at today, two geniuses merge their genius gloriously. And they're also part of a larger group or a revolutionary cohort called at the time the Lake Poets. And that label derives from the mountainous, beautiful, watery wilderness of northwest England. My native Alps, Wordsworth liked to call the region around his village Grasmere. Nature and redefinitions of nature, what it is, are at the heart of the Romantic revival. And nature, the English countryside, is no more beautiful than in Cumbria, Northumberland, Derbyshire, the Lake Country. Now, let me briefly summarise the lives of these two writers, Wordsworth and Coleridge, and the ways in which their poetry is intricately interwoven at the period of their maximum creativity, 1800. William Wordsworth was born in 1770 in the Lake District. He was the son of a lawyer, to whom he seems not to have been very close, particularly after the death of his mother when he was eight. His father died 5 years later. Now, according to the account given of his early life in his autobiographical poem, The Prelude, young William was allowed to run wild in nature, which became for him a kind of mother. And this is a refrain in his poetry, which is, to use a technical term, pantheistic. God inheres in the natural world around one. God is in nature. Now, Wordsworth's great autobiographical poem, The Prelude, opens, "Fair seed time had my soul, and I grew up fostered alike by beauty and by fear, much favoured in my birthplace." His birthplace, as I say, the Lake District. Notice the use of the term fostered in that opening. Mother Nature was to him a foster parent. This was an important conception for him. Now, more formally, young William was educated at grammar school. Now, there was much loneliness in his childhood, something that he again dwells on in the Prelude. It's a kind of what Keats called the egotistic sublime. Wordsworth is obsessed with himself. He's obsessed with Wordsworth. But this, of course, is part of the romantic project. Wordsworth's circumstances, early circumstances, rendered him, we may say, extraordinarily introverted. And solitude is a vital element in his psychological makeup. Another of Wordsworth's most famous poems, Daffodils, schoolteacher's favourite, opens, and pay attention, if you would, to the opening. "I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze." Now, if he had been in company, would that vision have been as significant to him? Loneliness and creativity are at the heart of Wordsworth's poetry. And loneliness for him is a creative state. Now, how to reconnect with society is one of the great problems in the Wordsworthian view of the poetic role, because the poet, of course, cannot stay forever outside, cannot stay forever by himself or herself. Well, to return to our brisk sort of profile of the man himself, Wordsworth attended Cambridge University, which taught him little, but where he learned much and had his first major intellectual stimulus from a visit to France at the crest of the early revolutionary period in 1790. "Bliss it was," he said, "to be alive in that year, but to be young was very heaven." In France, over the next couple of years, he had a relationship with a young French woman, Annette Vallon, of whom we know little except that it was very important to the young revolutionary Wordsworth. There was a child. Who knows, French people today, unbeknownst to themselves, may have the blood of Britain's greatest romantic poet coursing through their veins. Child, of course, was illegitimate. In the opening years of the new century, the 1800s, Wordsworth settled in the Lake District with his sister and in some sense his muse, Dorothy, and began to devote himself seriously to poetry. He was a poet by profession. Quite interesting that he had no other role in life than being a poet. In 1795, he'd met Samuel Taylor Coleridge, whose muse was both more philosophical and wilder than Wordsworth's. Opium and Immanuel Kant, the great German philosopher, these in fact came together in Coleridge's makeup. The two men, Wordsworth and Coleridge, travelled in Germany together in the late 1790s. It meant a lot more to Coleridge than it did to Wordsworth. Now, as for the opium connection, this was a period in history when, in fact, the drug was prescribed, opium was prescribed very freely as medicine, and was also available without prescription, usually in the form of laudanum, which is opium mixed with alcohol, and Coleridge became addicted to it. Now, the fruit of this relationship between Coleridge and Wordsworth was the collaborative volume Lyrical Ballads in 1798. It was reissued with a manifesto preface by Wordsworth in 1800, and again with an expanded introduction in 1802. These were called forth because it was a very influential volume. Now, it's arguably, although a classically slim volume of poetry, it is arguably the most influential such book in the whole of English literature. It was a bomb under the sedate establishment of verse, which had been erected so formally and so carefully by Dryden, Pope and Johnson, those Augustans that we looked at. Now, Lyrical Ballads was originally published without names, as if it were a production not of individual talent, but of the spirit of the time, the Zeitgeist, as they say in Germany. Now, Coleridge was also at this time living in the Lake District, close by Wordsworth. And his personal life, unlike Wordsworth, Coleridge's that is, was sexually chaotic. And you know, Wordsworth was always the stable one in this partnership, the good cop. Wordsworth's most famous one-line definition of poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings from emotions recollected in tranquility. Now, Coleridge, we may say, supplied the spontaneous power. Wordsworth, the tranquility, the thinking, the reflection. That they were a perfect team, even though they, like many perfect teams, they couldn't stay together very long. They broke up. Wordsworth would never, like Coleridge, have created one of the greatest short poems in the language, Kubla Khan, under the influence of a narcotic dream, under the influence of a drug. But then, unlike Coleridge, he would probably have finished the thing once it was so magnificently started. Coleridge just simply couldn't end it because, in fact, the drug wore off, the dream wore off, and he couldn't get round to finding where he'd finished. The inspiration was gone. Just to recall the magnificent opening of that poem I'm talking to, Kubla Khan, Coleridge's opium poem. In Xanadu de Kubla Khan, a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alf, the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers were girdled round, and there were gardens bright with sinuous rills where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree, and here were forests ancient as the hills, enfolding sunny spots of greenery. Well, he's really tripping there. Among Coleridge's more utopian projects was his pantisocratic community, based on free love and philosophical ideas. It was derived in large part from Mary Shelley's father, William Godwin, the idea for this. It failed utterly, as such communities typically do. Wordsworth's later life was tranquil, Coleridge's disastrously, catastrophically unsettled and upheaved. Briefly, Wordsworth married in 1802, and thereafter his career followed a much quieter track into fame, a much quieter, somewhat disillusioned, and ultimately very conservative political view of the world took him over. His last years were passed as poet laureate, loaded with honours. His great autobiographical poem, The Prelude, much revised, appeared in its final form a year after his death in 1850, and it is more properly a postlude than a prelude. Born in the late Augustan era, he died an eminent Victorian. But literary history identifies him as a giant of the Romantic revival. This was when he lived most as a poet, in the 1790s. Coleridge's life was, as I say, much more disordered. Few lives have been as disordered. He left in his chaotic wake a magnificent collection of fragments, short works and prolegomena. Like Wordsworth, and inspired by the mysteries of his own ego, he compiled a magnificent autobiography, prose in his case, Biographia Literaria, the biography of a literary sensibility. It's a work which fuses Coleridge's amazing sensibility, towering intellect, and his extraordinary powers of criticism and his feeling for poetry. Coleridge is, among his other achievements, the greatest theorist in English literature and a great critic, which Wordsworth wasn't. Coleridge died, wrecked by addiction, years before Wordsworth in 1834. And his greatest complete poem, which we'll be looking at in a few moments, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, was composed during his collaborative years with Wordsworth. And it was completed, partly, I think, because of Wordsworth being there alongside him, unlike the tantalizingly fragmentary Kubla Khan, which I was reading a few minutes ago. Wordsworth, in fact, was very good for Coleridge, but the relationship didn't last more than, at least in its kind of most creative form, didn't last for longer than a couple of years. Now, let's look more closely at what I've been alluding to, that explosive volume, Lyrical Ballads. Now, the title itself merits attention. Ballads, as was discussed in the Scott lecture, ballads are poetry of the folk, the people. They do not historically have single authors. They are the product of a community, a communal voice. Now, lyrics, on the other hand, songs, remember it's called lyrical ballads, may be thought aboriginally to be similarly authorless. Dig back, for example, into the cultural subsoil that produced one of the richest harvests of ballad and song in North America, I'm referring to the blues, and you don't find, as it were, composers. What you find is an oppressed people. Now, ballad revival took fire across Europe in the late 18th century as that period rediscovered the primal, pre-literary energies of literature. It was as if the poets of the time sank shafts like oilmen into a new source of fuel deep beneath the historical surface of their society. Now, the ballad revival also marked a desire to return to cleansing simplicities, the natural world of literature, away from the industrialization, the institutionalization, which was the bureaucratization, which was transforming, deforming their world. They wanted to get rid of the machine and the garden, and ballads was one way of doing that. Goethe and Schiller, great German figures, were ballad revivalists, and significantly Wordsworth and Coleridge were in Germany in the period running up to Lyrical Ballads. In Britain, ballad collectors like Bishop Percy with his Reliques and Scott with his Minstrelsy of the Scottish Border had amassed a historical archive of British balladry. And there were traditions for poets like Wordsworth and Coleridge to draw on. And this belief that at the dawn of the industrial age, poetry could return to the primal level of its history, the ballad, was, of course, it was a fallacy. But romantic literature thrives on fallacies. And the most famous, of course, is what's called the pathetic fallacy. The notion that nature, this is pantheistic, of course, that nature cares about us. But the idea that an untrammeled state of nature was recoverable, Coleridge's Edenic Pantistocracy, for example, was one example of this, along with certain other ways of writing about was another fallacy. But nonetheless, these were fallacies which were, as it were, sort of ideologically necessary. And they had, these fallacies had sort of sublime literary results. I mean, take one of Wordsworth's most loved and famous poems, the poem which is also, I think, his greatest anthem to his pantheism, Tintern Abbey. The situation is this is the scenario. The poet has returned to the country around the river Wye after 5 long years of absence. This return to nature is a homecoming, we apprehend. On his return, the poet Wordsworth has a moment of transcendent vision. He's standing by a ruined abbey. The Romantics loved ruins almost as much as they loved nature. And he has an overpowering sense of what he calls a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. It's wonderful, but hold on a second. Wordsworth is too honest a poet not to notice something else in the landscape, although he doesn't press the point, leaving the reader to pick it up. Let me quote again. Once again I see these hedgerows, hardly hedgerows, little lines of sportive wood run wild, these pastoral farms, green to the very door, and wreaths of smoke sent up in silence from among the trees. Are they hermits, the poet says? Are they dwellers in the houseless woods, alone, solitary people? Well, no, as it happens, they're not. They're charcoal burners. what they're doing is they're creating the fuel which would, as it were, kickstart the first wave of the Industrial Revolution. Wordsworth, of course, knew that, but when he bought into the fallacy that smoke was in fact, as it were, innocent, natural, he was creating a magnificent fiction. Now, Lyrical Ballads, as was said, was first published in 1798. Now, it was, in this first appearance, the poems and nothing else, including this poem, Tintern Abbey. The poems were offered without any kind of apparatus or surrounding explanation. It was offered also namelessly, as indeed true ballads came from nowhere, came from the people, without, as it were, authorial ownership. Later editions of Lyrical Ballads do carry authorial names, and they also carry Wordsworth's pugnacious poetic manifesto. And in that manifesto, we find the three revolutionary elements I mentioned earlier: resistance to oppression, populism, and utopianism. What then was the oppression that he and Coleridge were opposing? It was, as Wordsworth contemptuously puts it, gaudy and inane phraseology, the poetic diction of the Augustans, in other words. Wordsworth, in an appendix, gives an example of what he means by gaudy and inane phraseology. It's from a poem which we've examined, and speaking for myself, which we've admired, Johnson's The Vanity of Human Wishes. This is what Johnson wrote. "Turn on the prudent ant thy heedless eyes, observe her labours, sluggard, and be wise. No stern command, no monetary voice, prescribes her duties or directs her choice. Yet timely provident, she hastes away to snatch the blessings of a plenteous day." From this hubbub of words, says Wordsworth, he despises it, pass to the original. In the King James Bible, whose prose, incidentally, we've also admired in an earlier lecture, this is what the Bible says, and what Johnson is drawing on in that passage from The Vanity. "Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways, and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer, and gathereth her food in the harvest. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall thy poverty come as one that travelleth, and thy want as an armed man." That's from Proverbs. Now, are Wordsworth's objections and insults against Johnson fair? No, they're not. But when did a revolutionary worry about being fair? Now, to draw a broad distinction, in the Lyrical Ballads, Wordsworth took on the political agenda and Coleridge explored the primitive supernaturalism associated with balladry. Wordsworth's political poetics were, as he said, this in fact was his, if you like, mission, to choose incidents and situations from common life and to relate or describe them throughout as far as was possible in a selection of language really used by men. It's a simple statement, but in literary terms it's dynamite. Arguably, the above example from the King James Bible, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard," is the language really used by men. But can poetry realistically straitjacket itself in this way? Are not compromises necessary? Now, Wordsworth, when pressed, wriggles somewhat. He says that the poet is a man of more than usual organic sensibility, a man who's thought long and deeply, an unusual man. Now, would such a man really confine his poetic expression to the language of the streets or the rural village? Ballads might do this, but sophisticated poetry at the present age, in the 1800s, the poet is a man speaking to men, but a man, as Wordsworth says, endowed with a more lively sensibility, more enthusiasm and tenderness, who has a greater knowledge of human nature. A man, that is, who is both common and uncommon, ordinary and extraordinary. Now, gifted as he is with words, Wordsworth cannot entirely disentangle himself from this contradiction. Nor should we expect him to. The value of what he's doing is not in his logic, but in the poetry which his illogical thinking produces. And at its best, in the Lyrical Ballads, it is a poetry of a stunning purity and power. I want to give just one example. It's from a group of poems included in one of the later reprints of Lyrical Ballads. They're called the Lucy Poems, we do not actually know who Lucy was any more than we know, for example, who was the girl who runs away with the raggle-taggle gypsies in the traditional ballad. What we do know, however, is that the balladeer, not Wordsworth, of course, loved her, and she is dead. This is the poem. A slumber did my spirit seal. I had no human fears. She seemed a thing that could not feel the touch of earthly years. No motion has she now, no force. She neither hears nor sees, rolled round in earth's diurnal course with rocks and stones and trees. Now, this is the whole poem. It's breathtakingly simple, and yet the emotion compressed within its eight lines has nuclear power, it seems to me. One can see what Wordsworth was looking for in ancient balladry, this primal energy by which the simplest words come alive. And yet, was there not one word which stood out as I read it? Diurnal. That is the word of a scholar, not a balladeer. Now, Wordsworth could very easily have used the term daily. It would have meant the same, and it would have been the language of a man really talking to men. He did not. He used gaudy and inane phraseology. He wanted his cake and to eat it too. Now, we forgive the contradiction in the face of the beauty of what is produced. Coleridge's agenda was different. The Rime of the Ancient Mariner is the first work in the lyrical ballads that he got the prime spot. In it, Coleridge compacts into short line, four line stanzas an amazingly pregnant and mystical narrative of the condition of man in an incomprehensible natural universe, a universe where there is a religious order, but an order which is baffling, enigmatic, beyond reason's capacity to understand, although mysteriously meanings may be sensed. Coleridge drew on Gothic fiction, on an extraordinary range of reading, on theology, philosophy, and travel books. And with reference to the last, let me just quote a couple of quatrains describing the mariner's voyage into the Arctic regions. Listen, stranger, mist and snow, and it grew wondrous cold, and ice mast high came floating by, as green as emerald. And through the drifts the snowy cliffs descend a dismal sheen. Nay shapes of men, nay beasts we ken, the ice was all between. The ice was here, the ice was there, the ice was all around. It cracked and growled and roared and howled like noises of a swan. Swan is means swoon. Now, the spelling's antique, cold, not cold, and there are archaisms like swound I just mentioned. But the vividness is, I think, not merely photographic, but verbal technicolour. This is the quality of the poem. The narrative of the rhyme is very simple. The poet is going to church, a happy wedding's in prospect. But what is this? He stopped on the way. It is an ancient mariner who stops him, and he stoppeth one of three. And then there's the description or the exchange between the two of them. By thy long grey beard and thy glittering eye, now wherefore stoppest me? Asked the poet. And it turns out he's being stopped to hear an amazing story, how on a voyage past the line from frozen north to the tropics a strange adventure occurred. He, the ancient mariner, shot an albatross, the seabird which follows ships. With its huge wingspan, the albatross is often taken as symbolic of the crucified Christ. It is also, as superstition, sailors' superstition has it, very bad luck to kill an albatross. Why the mariner shot the albatross with his crossbow, we never know. But it has terrible consequences. The ship finds itself marooned in a windless ocean. The sailors thirst horribly. The sun blazes. Even the sea seems to rot around them. Day after day, we stuck. Nay breath, nay motion, as idle as a painted ship upon a painted ocean. Water, water everywhere, and all the boards did shrink. Water, water everywhere, nay any drop to drink. The very deeps did rot, O Christ, that ever this should be. Yea, slimy things, they crawl with legs upon the slimy sea. Well, the sailors curse the mariner. We never know his name or anything about him other than what happened on his voyage. He went on a trip, shot an albatross. And eventually all the sailors die except for the mariner and, of course, the million slimy things in the ocean. Finally, after strange visitations from spirits beyond man's understanding, the mariner has himself a spiritual conversion. He finally blesses these slimy sea things around the vessel and miraculously he's freed. The skeleton, the bones of the albatross, which his sailors, other sailors have put round his neck, they drop from him. And he is reborn, but he's reborn as aged and wizened, an older and a wiser man. On the point of death, we assume, when he has his exchange with the wedding guest. But nonetheless, before he dies, he must pass on his vision. And here he becomes a kind of version of the romantic poet. But no one will listen to him. That's why, in fact, he had to grab the wedding guest almost by the lapels and hold him while he tells the story. The wedding guest listens to him, and he too is described at the end of the poem as an older and a wiser man. He's learned from the poetry. It's a symbolic allegorization of how poetry works. But if we ask, and I don't know anyone who reads it that doesn't ask, if we ask, what does it mean? Well, the answer is the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner means what it is. It's a thing of huge power, indicating the new kinds of directions which poetry could, and thanks to Wordsworth and Coleridge, would take over the next two centuries. A revolution had happened, arguably. It is still happening. Lyrical ballads changed English literature forever.